It's in a die in Tallahassee as the legislative session wraps up. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen anytime. There or on iTunes, and stream us live every morning on Facebook, too. Just ahead, all about that legislative session, which isn't done yet, by the way. What did and didn't get passed? Will the governor veto the budget and force a special session? What about medical marijuana and more? We'll speak with Florida Times Union Tallahassee Bureau Chief Tia Mitchell. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, May marks Stroke Awareness Month. Know the signs and symptoms. Plus, Culpepper on this week's fun at the Players Championship. All of that and more ahead. But first, this hour, the legislative session that was scheduled to end Friday, well, it's extending into today as the House and Senate try to come to terms on the state budget. So again, just so we're keeping score here, the legislature once again has failed in its primary duty to pass a budget during its 60-day session. And with time running out, the budget isn't the only thing lagging this session in the state capitol. Lawmakers also had a really hard time resolving two important policy issues: implementing the medical marijuana constitutional amendment, overwhelmingly approved by the voters, and reforming workers' compensation insurance after a court struck down a previous law that caused insurance rates to spike almost overnight. And there's a lot to talk about, too, when it comes to a last-minute piece of legislation that could bring profound changes to Florida's schools. Florida Times Union Tallahassee Bureau Chief Tia Mitchell is our woman in the state capitol, and she's on the line with the latest. Hi, Tia. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. And the number to join us as we talk about the end of the legislative session, whether it's medical marijuana, the budget, education, we want to know what you think. Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or you can weigh in on Facebook. So, Tia, as you report this morning, lawmakers tinkered until the last minute, but still had no agreement by Friday night when they typically drop the handkerchief and say, sin a die, and end the legislative session. So they're going on into today. What is the agenda for today, and can they get to an agreement on a budget for the state of Florida?
I do think they will reach an agreement today. The only thing on the agenda are the budget-related bills, but there are about a dozen of them altogether. The main budget, the General Appropriations Act, but there are several related pieces of legislation that help implement the budget or that change state law in ways that impact the budget. And so they've got a lot of different pieces of legislation to vote on today, but they expect to get it done probably late tonight.
And why was it so difficult, once again, do you think, for them to get this done? This is, after all, their primary duty.
I think the main reason is that when you look at Senate President Joe Negron's priorities and you look at House Speaker Richard Corcoran's priorities, what they really, really believed in, what's really important to them, not only were they each looking at a completely different set of priorities, but in some places those priorities were in direct conflict with each other. For example, Senate President Negron wanted to boost spending on state universities. Speaker Corcoran at one point wanted to cut state universities' budgets very significantly. So when you try to work out an agreement on things that both men really want to get done, that made it hard to craft a budget. And in Tallahassee, so many policy issues get held up when they can't agree on the budget. It just kind of slows everything else down.
Right. And is there any chance, in your view, that Governor Scott will veto the budget and send them back into special session?
That is an option. And Governor Scott has said repeatedly that he does not like what the budget has for Visit Florida and Enterprise Florida for business incentives. That was one of those things that Richard Corcoran insisted on defunding. And he, for the most part, got his way. And now the way he's crafted it is some of these related budget bills are tied to Visit Florida and Enterprise Florida funding. So if Governor Scott were to veto the related bills, he would also be eliminating Florida by his eliminating the funding by his own veto pen. And therefore, I do not think Governor Scott is going to veto entire bills or veto the entire budget. But he does still have line item veto power, and you might see him sending a message in certain things he does decide to delete from the budget.
All right. And if you're just tuning in, it's your chance to connect with Tallahassee Bureau Chief, The Times Union's Tia Mitchell. As legislators come to the end of their session, lots of bills going through the process that will affect you out there. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Now, of course, the budget is hugely important, but Tia, the topic that's grabbed a lot of headlines this session is medical marijuana. Florida voters approved Amendment 2 by 71% in November. Still, though, patients with chronic illnesses that really are hoping to have access to this drug, they don't have access to it yet. Where do things stand with medical marijuana in Florida at the end of the session?
Well, what the bill did not pass, and unlike the budget proposals, which can get a vote today, all other policy issues that did not get passed by Friday, which was the scheduled end of session, those all are now no longer in play. You have to start over. So for medical marijuana, the Department of Health can try to implement some rules and regulations in the interim. There is also a chance that lawmakers or Governor Scott could come back, could call lawmakers back for a special session to deal with medical marijuana. What most lawmakers are saying is that because of the way their calendar is set up, the 2018 session will start earlier. They'll actually start committee meetings in September. So we're just a few months away from starting the 2018 session. And I think they're just going to, even if they do a special session in September or October, they're already scheduled to be in Tallahassee. And so I do think they're going to wait till then to pick medical marijuana back up. So folks are just going to have to wait a few more months.
And so as it stands now, there are only a few dispensaries around the state where you can access this product. Isn't that right?
Yes. And the big hang-up that caused the medical marijuana bill to not get approved is that the House and the Senate had different ideas about whether you should cap the number of dispensaries any one company could open around the state. There's a free market argument that, you know, if you have a license to dispense, you should be able to open as many as you can afford and as many as customers will support. But the other side said, no, we want to cap dispensaries because we don't want any one company to have a monopoly on dispensing medical marijuana. We don't want, you know, one company to come in and just kind of control the market. And those are two very valid arguments, and there are vehement supporters on both sides. And without being able to reach an agreement, the bill died.
And if you're just tuning in, what are your questions for the Times Union's Tia Mitchell on the state budget, medical marijuana, education, and more? We'll go to your calls in a moment as the legislature comes to the end of its 60-day session at 549-2937. Now, Tia, we're getting a lot of tweets about this mammoth education bill that moved through Tallahassee at the last minute. Parents and teachers are begging the legislature to reject this public schools bill. It's 278 pages long, a $419 million measure decided behind closed doors. What's in this bill and what would it do, and why are people urging a veto or a vote no on this?
There are so many things in this bill. There's the Schools of Hope legislation that creates new measures for chronically underperforming DNF schools. There's a piece in there that requires recess. There's a piece in there talking about school uniforms. There's a piece in there for the teacher incentives under the Best and Brightest program. There are so many things in this bill, and this bill was negotiated and finalized in secret. You know, the legislature can do things in private that maybe other governing bodies cannot. And therefore, when this massive proposal came out that combined so many other pieces of legislation that had been percolating around session, number one, it just did not get a public vetting. they had public comment the day the bill was released, but if you just got the bill 5 minutes ago, it's hard to put public comment together. So there was really no public comment. There was really no ability for the public to review the bill in a way that can shape it, because once the conference committee agrees, which happened the same day the bill was publicized, once they agree, you can't amend it. All the legislature can do is either vote it up or vote it down, which will happen today. I do think the bill still passes because, again, there are so many things in it that different lawmakers like that it's hard to vote no on a proposal. Even if it has things you don't like, it has many more things you do like. And so I know that parent groups, teacher groups are really upset because, again, they just weren't able to have influence on this bill. It was done very privately, and it does contain a lot of funding. I believe over $600 million worth of funding is tied to this one bill that all lawmakers can do today is either vote yes or vote no.
And you think it'll pass?
I do. I think all the bills today ultimately pass. I do think this education legislation probably will be the closest vote, will probably have the most no votes of anything else besides possibly the General Appropriations Act, but I do think it still passes today.
And here's a tweet from a listener. Two guys horse trading, bad education policy that wouldn't pass public scrutiny. Here's another tweet from Lisa. Why wasn't Florida Forever funded? She's talking about land conservation. And Tia, that brings me to another question for you. This accusation throughout the session that the legislature isn't conducting their business in a transparent way, despite promising to do so. Also, a week or two ago, the New York Times decided to weigh in on our state government with this scathing op-ed calling the leadership in Tallahassee obstructionist toils, trying to foil and blunt the will of the voters by slow rolling ballot approved initiatives on everything from medical marijuana, which we just talked about, to solar power, which was approved by the voters, education, we just talked about that, also the environment, the land conservation, Amendment 1, approved by the voters. What about these accusations we've seen all through the legislative session that the Republican leadership in Tallahassee is ignoring the will of the people on all of these ballot initiatives voters approved at the polls?
Yeah, I just think it's, well, let's take them piece by piece. First, let's talk about land conservation, Florida Forever. It is true that in the classic way we consider Florida Forever, there isn't a lot of money this year. However, it is not true to say that they're not spending on the environment this year. Senate President Joe Negron's top priority was additional storage for runoff of Lake Okeechobee to stop those big, you know, pollution events that happen in Indian River that he represents. And he got that funding. That's a big chunk of funding that is in the budget. That is Senate President Joe Negron's priority. That's where a lot of the conservation funding went this year. There is money in the budget for the St. John's River and Keystone Lakes area, Keystone Heights area lakes. That's something that Senator Rob Bradley was able to also get into the budget. That's just for Northeast Florida. So there are these different projects sprinkled around, but by and large, most of that money is going to Senate President Negron's Lake Okeechobee Reservoir. He's the Senate president. He has the position of power to get what he wants done, and that's what happened this year. Now, take the medical marijuana. We have a conservative legislature by and large. They did not necessarily support medical marijuana, but now they're in a position to implement the constitutional amendment. So they do it in a way that is comfortable to them and their conservative viewpoint. And so that's where the rub is. That's where some proponents of the constitutional amendment say, we had this in mind, but now the legislature is implementing it and they're not doing it in the way we intended. Well, that, again, elections have consequences. We have conservative lawmakers running our legislature. And if you at home don't like that, then at the ballot, you have to think about who you're putting in the legislature.
All right, let's go to your calls now for, yeah, sure. For Tia Mitchell, sorry, Tia, I just want to get a few callers on the line with you.
Sure.
It's 549-2937. Julie in San Marco. Go ahead, Julie.
No, I'm thinking about who I'm putting in the legislature. I just want to register my utter disgust with the way that these laws are being passed, particularly the education laws being packed into what we call trains at the last minute to be voted on in the form of a budget conforming bill. We've already been told by superintendents across the state that the Schools of Hope piece of legislation is a bad idea for a public school students. These two guys horse trading, you know, it's not about two egos in the House and the Senate. This is about 3 million public school children, and I am just so angry I can't even think straight. You know, the teacher incentives, the best and brightest legislation is about the worst piece of incentive legislation. You know, we need to increase teacher salary and not play around with these stupid ideas that somebody reads on a plane. I the legislative process should be happening in public hearings with public feedback and public scrutiny. And for these two guys to go behind closed doors and pack all of this stuff at the last minute into these bills is just disgusting to me.
All right. Strong opinions on that education bill. Thank you for that call, Julie. Tia.
Yeah, I again, it's one of those things that I will say Schools of Hope, Democrats, particularly Representative Chevron Jones, Representative Larry Lee, did work with Republicans, and they did feel like the Schools of Hope portion of that bill is more palatable than it started out. So they're not completely happy, but they do feel like, for example, now Schools of Hope funding can be used by the school districts and the school boards. They don't have to automatically turn those schools over to charter schools. So there were things added to Schools of Hope that did assuage some concerns. But again, there wasn't a lot of public comment about the final version of the bill.
Chuck at the Beaches. Hello, Chuck. Happy Monday.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
I was hoping your guest could tell us a little bit about what we may have done for health care for the underprivileged. I know there's been some issues with Medicaid in Florida and also with the Affordable Care Act in Florida. You had to make at least $12,000, I think, to be on the Affordable Care Act. So has there been any progress? I think we have a fairly bad reputation as far as it goes, as far as helping the underprivileged. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Chuck. What about health care, Tia?
Hi, Chuck. Again, this is one of those things where I will say elections have consequences. We have a conservative legislature. Once again, they definitely are not expanding health care access. That is not on the table. That is not a priority in the legislature right now. One thing Speaker Richard Corcoran does want to do is change health care in the way it's offered to state employees. So he has started putting those things in motion. For example, he is working on offering lower cost health care plans to state employees and allowing them to pocket the premiums that the state no longer has to pay in exchange for perhaps a higher deductible and things like that. That only affects state employees. That's something he's working on. As far as Medicaid, hospitals were cut this year because, again, the Speaker and the President of the Senate had priorities. Hospitals were not on their priority list, and so therefore to expand spending in places they wanted to expand spending, they cut hospital spending.
And what about,
so that is
Tia,
in the budget.
What about our safety net hospital, UF Health?
Yes.
What about UF
right
Health?
Now,
I'm hearing a lot that there could be trouble for UF Health on the funding side if the legislature doesn't, make this a priority. Yes. Is UF Health needing to worry?
UF Health is in line for a budget cut. However, the state is still negotiating with the federal government how the expanded low-income pool program will work. And so I did talk to Russ Armistead, who's the CEO of UF Health Jacksonville, over the weekend, actually. Right now they're in line for an $18 to $19 million cut, which is substantial. But what they're hoping is that low-income pool funding, which is not a factor in the budget right now, they're hoping that low-income pool funding can be applied in the way that largely offsets that cut. We won't know for a few more weeks if that happens. If that does not happen, you will hear a lot of conversation about what will be done for U.S. Health, because they cannot withstand an $18 to $19 million cut. That will either require more local funding, that will either require large reductions in workforce or to kind of bring their budget in. But right now we're in a holding position because even though their state funding is being cut, low-income pool funding is still being worked out.
We will watch that so closely, Tia. Our safety net hospital problems there could cascade to the entire health system in this community. That's one to keep our eye on. Meanwhile, lots of calls for Tia Mitchell. Brian in Ponte Vedra. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling about the School of Hope, the Schools of Hope. And I just want to talk about or make a comment that I really believe that this is just another corporate charter welfare giveaway. Basically, they are allowing or want to allow charter schools to open in these areas where we have D's and F schools. And it's the legislature, it's the Republican Party that created these D's and F schools. The Republican Party has been in control of the legislature for the last 22 or three decades, and the public school system that is failing is the public school system that the Republican Party created. And Schools of Hope will do nothing for our poor rural communities that need more resources. What they should do, instead of giving that $200 million to a bunch of for-profit charter schools, is they should give that money to the public schools so they can make the changes in these rural poor schools that need to be done. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Tia?
And I do think, you know, there, at the end of the day, it all comes down to funding. At the end of the day, you know, school districts will say exactly what Brian just said, which is, if you gave us more money, we can help, we can improve these schools, we know what needs to be done. I do think the Schools of Hope, this is a priority of House Speaker Corcoran. Because he's in a position of power, he's able to push this kind of untested theory that charter schools can turn around these largely poor inner city or rural schools, which is where most DNS schools are, either in the inner city or they're in rural communities. So we're going to see essentially whether his hypothesis works or not.
And by the way, a comment on that on our Facebook page from Scott. I hope the charter school bill is favorable to those who have personally invested in schools here in Jacksonville. Meanwhile, Rob emails the show saying, my worst fears have come true. The government is ignoring the will of the people conducting business behind closed doors. Florida citizens lose when that happens. Let's take one more call from Richard in Middleburg now. Hi, Richard. How are you?
Hi, good morning. Going back to the medical marijuana issue, we've got some pretty cruel, heartless commissioners in this state that have instituted one-year bans on medical marijuana dispensaries, and especially one here in Clay County. And what I read in the paper was that they are nervous about the Department of Health taking over this whole issue. And I'm wondering, is that a bad idea? And if so, why?
Okay, thanks, Richard. Tia, what about that?
Well, most of those local, you know, county commissions and city councils who instituted the ban did it because they said they wanted to wait to see how the law implemented the medical marijuana amendment so they could then create local laws that were comfortable to them. You know, Jacksonville might have a different idea than St. Augustine or Baker County. So once again, without the legislature passing a bill, that means these local governments still don't know how medical marijuana is going to be implemented. And that's why they're hesitant. That's why they're calling moratoriums, because they don't want to scramble later because they don't like kind of how the Department of Health has implemented it. I will say that no matter what, if the Department of Health is tasked with implementing this proposal, it will be locked up in court probably for years, which is what happened when the first medical marijuana bill got passed. There are a lot of administrative and legal challenges because it's such a a lucrative and new industry for businesses. And so I do think these are so preliminary, and without legislation, it makes it even tougher because now the Department of Health has to do it all.
Well, we will continue to follow that and all of the other issues. Meanwhile, awesome, awesome reporting from you, as always, Tia Mitchell. And we thank you so much for getting on the line with us. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tia Mitchell, the Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Florida Times Union, as the legislature winds down its 60-day session. More about all those items on our website later today at wjctnews.org as we cover state government for you. And much more still ahead on this show later. Cole Pepper with everything you need to know about Players Week at TPC Sawgrass. Lots of changes to the stadium course. But up next, why time is so critical and 911 is so important when treating stroke. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Next time on 1A, billionaires and philanthropy. Their money is changing the world, but where's it all going and for what purpose? The gap between the haves and the have-nots is widening, and America's super elite can move public policy in ways that elected leaders often can't. Coming to grips with the new Gilded Age, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Flagler County is celebrating their centennial year. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll look at the last 100 years in Flagler County. We'll discuss a firsthand account of the Battle of Pensacola in 1814 and talk about the Orlando company Randall Made Knives, supplier of knives to hunters, soldiers, and astronauts since the 1930s. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. The best in classic and modern blues as part of WJCT's After Hours. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
I don't want no woman telling me what to do.
Welcome back. Only 20% of stroke patients get to an emergency room in time to receive the brain-saving treatment that can save their lives. Timely action and access to a certified stroke center can make all the difference in recovery. But still, about 80% of stroke patients delay seeking that critical fast treatment right away. That's something the month of May, National Stroke Awareness Month, seeks to change. With more, we welcome Dr. Nima Aga Ibrahim, MD. He's an interventional neurologist with Baptist Health and Lyerly Neurosurgery and the Baptist Stroke and Cerebrovascular Center. And he joins us now with more about how important it is to get treatment immediately if a stroke occurs. Dr. Nima, good to see you.
Thank you very much for having me. Good to see you as well.
So 80% of stroke patients don't get that critical fast treatment. Why is that? They don't realize how serious it is?
Yeah, exactly. I think awareness is the main issue, and people just don't realize that stroke is very common. So, for example, stroke is number one cause of disability in the United States. So the immediate seeking of treatment is very important.
Mm-hmm. And the saying is, trauma responders and doctors always say, time is brain. The more time goes by, the more brain damage you're going to see, right?
Exactly. So what happens is with the stroke, there's a blockage in one of the blood vessels. And every minute that passes, there are about 1.9 million neurons die. So really, every minute that passes, the brain is getting damaged. And it is important to recognize a sign of a stroke. And once someone suspects a stroke, the important thing is to call 911 right away.
Don't drive yourself to the hospital.
Don't drive yourself and don't wait to see if it gets better, because I think that's the main problem. People don't seek help.
So if you have any of these symptoms, off balance, dizziness, nausea, eyesight changes, drooping face or arm, slurred speech, call 911. Don't wait.
Exactly. And we short name for BFAS, and those are the exact things that you just mentioned. And if you suspect a stroke, call 911 right away. We have now treatments available for stroke to reverse some of the stroke symptoms, but these treatments have to be given as fast as possible. So that's why it's so important.
Let's talk about Baptist Certified Stroke Center. It's the Baptist Health Stroke and Cerebrovascular Center, the most advanced stroke care in the region. Yeah.
Yes, we have very good, very advanced technology that we can help with these patients who come in with a stroke. We have a very good dedicated team. Recently, we have a new process where we can get the patients to emergency room very fast to do this treatment faster by doing pre-notification, by working with personnel from EMS and the whole team involved.
You also have some clinical trials going on around stroke. What are they looking at?
Exactly. So also, it's very important to get treatment as fast as possible, but now we have some clinical trial that we are part of that they're looking at to see if you come in a little longer time, can we still provide that acute care where we go through the blood vessel from the leg to access the brain blood clot and remove that. We are part of multiple clinical trials, and one of them specific, or two of them specific, looking at expanding that time window where we can do this kind of treatment.
But again, that BFAST is so important, and that stands for balance, eyesight, face, arm, speech, time. A good way to remember fast action if you have any of those symptoms. It can make, if somebody gets to you within the hour of these symptoms, they can make a full recovery.
Yeah,
and well, not always,
it,
but often.
Not always. And we see that, and that's why it's so important for people to understand if you see a stroke, it is an emergency, you need to call 911. And be fast really means you need to be fast and act as fast as possible.
Dr. Nima, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
He's Dr. Nima Aga Ibrahim, interventional neurologist with Baptist Health and Lyerly Neurosurgery in the Baptist Stroke and Cerebrovascular Center. And much more still to come. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Gabourey Sidibe. She made her acting debut in Lee Daniels' 2009 film Precious, a role that got her an Oscar nomination for Best Actress. Since then, she's been in Empire, The Big C, and American Horror Story. Sidibe has a new memoir called This Is Just My Face, Try Not to Stare. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On WJCT's radio reading service at 8 a.m. weekday mornings, it's 3 hours of news, op-eds, and obituaries from your local newspaper. Here's a call we received from someone who listens online.
I'm very happy to tell you that my daughter found the app for the radio reading service on my tablet, and I'm using that, and it's excellent. I enjoy all the programs.
If you're living with blindness and want to hear what's in the paper, go to wjct.org/radio reading, underwritten by Florida Eye Specialists.
Derry Touchton was acting crazy again.
He was quoting scripture a good bit and singing.
Someone called the cops.
I need a deputy down here.
Okay,
quick.
Driver, step out of your car, get your hands where I can see you.
And 35 seconds later,
shots fired, subject is down.
Derry was dead. Would better police training have saved his life? On the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the world watched closely Sunday as France held its presidential election. The centrist Emmanuel Macron handily beat far-right candidate Marine Le Pen. Now, whether your interest in France is political, cultural, gastronomic, or all three of the above, you can take advantage of an upcoming French language trip to Jacksonville's sister city in France later this year. Yeah, we have a sister city over there. Here's how you can be part of it, as we're pleased to welcome Sheila Cloak of Alliance Française. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Richard Shieldhouse with the Nantes Committee, and that sister city is Nantes. Hey, Richard.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. Sheila, let's begin with you. This is a sister city cultural exchange, so people from Jacksonville can travel to Nantes. That's our sister city. Tell us about Nantes, France.
Well, the sister cities are chosen because they can relate to the home city of Jacksonville. And really, it's a program that allows ordinary citizens to go over and experience French life for 2 weeks.
Two-week program, Richard. This is all going to be done in French. What all's part of this trip?
What is part of it? Well, there will be 6 days, 6 mornings of classes, followed by an optional lunch, which is also included in the fee that we the €250 fee that covers the whole thing, except for the airplane flight. There will be afternoon activities, tours and so on, and occasional evening things and maybe official events with city officials. There also will be, you know, this is also an important anniversary for the U.S. and France. This is the 100th anniversary of the arrival of 2 million plus U.S. troops in France, and they were arriving mostly right around there in Saint-Nazaire. And they began arriving there on the 26th of June, 1917. So it's going to be a period of time, a couple weeks, with a lot of We Love America commemorative events.
Well, that'll be nice to see.
Yeah.
So people understand this, that for about $275, they can go over there, have French language classes every day, lots of French meals paid for, lots of touristy trips all around the area, all for $275. They have to pay for their plane fare, though, correct?
Yes.
That's
yes,
the price.
That is correct.
And tell us a little bit more about Nantes, the city, what they'll get to see.
Nantes is a very cultural city. It was industrial. Lots of shipbuilding. And the city has really transformed itself, I would say, since after the Second World War. Lots of museums, lots of gardens, plenty to see, plenty to do. I think it'll be a wonderful experience for people.
And they'll be coming right after this really closely watched election. That's been fascinating to see as well, the American interest in that French election.
Well, I think people will also get to understand really a little about the French political system and also the French attitude to politics. People talk about it all the time at the dinner table with family and friends, and people are not shy about putting forward their opinions.
Not like, sort of like America in its own way, but different, because obviously the French system is different. But Richard, what was it like last year for the people that embarked on this trip?
They all loved it. The main result we did, we took their temperature when they got back, and the main finding was that the highlight of the trip for everybody was staying in a French household.
And you stay with a family.
Yeah. And you see how they live, you see how they eat, you know, you're eating normal French food rather than tourist food, and watching French television, drinking French wine, you know.
And you're taking French lessons so you can try to communicate with your hosts, right?
That's true, although some of them were very eager to try out their English skills, too, which wasn't too helpful if you wanted to learn French.
I see. But the whole idea of this is to really try to learn the language and experience the culture, really immerse yourself in it. Yeah?
That's the main idea, yeah. So if you learn something about the culture and you learn something about the language, that's a big victory. And you know, last year we had some people who were absolute beginners who knew nothing about French. And I think even for them, they learned something.
It's cool, too, that we have a sister city in this country. And as you said, the shipbuilding industry is there. So there are some parallels between Jacksonville and Nantes. How can people sign up to go on this trip?
they can look us up on our website, www.afjacksonville.org. They can get in touch with Sister Cities Association within Jacksonville. And I think there'll be there's information on both of those sites about the trip.
But afjacksonville.org, and the deadline's coming up soon.
The deadline is coming. Yeah, the deadline is coming up soon. We still have some slots available. We're trying this year to have fewer than we had last year. We're trying to make it more intimate and easier for our partners over there to organize events. We probably should give the listeners the email address if they'd, which is.
afjacks@aol.com.
Okay, it's afjacksonville.org to register for the Sister City trip to Nantes. It's June 26th to July 1st, so wait.
Can I mention one other thing, though? In relation to the 100th anniversary of World War I, people will have the option of coming a few days early and going on a cruise to three different World War I sites, which will cost another maybe $40 or $50.
All right. Lots of options there. Check the website, afjacksonville.org. Richard Shieldhouse with the Nantes Committee, Sheila Cloak of Alliance Francaise, and merci. I took high school French, and I barely remember any of it. Oh. But I speak what I as much as I can. We'll be right back with a look at Players Week.
Jennifer, this sounds like one of those stories where you're gonna really embarrass yourself. And then I thought, wait, no. Because I thought that, nothing is gonna happen.
Join us next time for stories of mortal sins, polar bears, rock stars, and more. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Quick, give me the names of every state capital that include the word city. Come on, what's the holdup? I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Do you have way too much information floating around in your head? Then NPR's Ask Me Another might just be for you. It's a whole hour of puzzles, word games, and trivia. Oh, and the answers are Oklahoma City, Carson City, Jefferson City, and Salt Lake City. But you knew that, right?
Sundays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. It's Players Week at TPC Sawgrass. Lots of exciting events all week long, of course, and on the golf course. Culpepper will tell us about that in a minute. But here's the secret weapon to the players. More than 2,000 volunteers, and they also help generate $84 million for charity. This year's volunteer force includes Kevin English, chairman of Redcoat, on the players' volunteer leadership team. And he's on the line now. Hey, Kevin, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks so much for being with us. You know, you're leading this great team out there, involved in every aspect of making the players come off without a hitch. Player services, facilities, spectator, and fan experience. Tell us all about what's happening. And also, there's a program to honor the volunteers, the PGA Tour Volunteer Challenge. What all is going to be happening out there this week with that?
Yeah, it's going to be an amazing week. We got started this morning with what we call Adopt a Hole. So we fanned out across the course and picked up the last remaining trash or anything that might be on the course. The course looks great. And yes, we've got the Volunteer Challenge kicked off as well. That's another opportunity for our volunteers to earn votes so they can try to win the challenge and give additional money to charity of their choice. So the volunteer with the most votes gets to give $2,500 to their charity. So it's just another way our volunteers can have an impact on the community and organizations in Northeast Florida.
That is so fantastic. Now, tell us about your role and why you keep coming back and as a Red Coat, what that means for you. It's your 10th year, I think, as a tournament volunteer.
Yeah, that's right. I got started 10 years ago. A friend of mine, Robert Davis, gave me a call and asked me to come out. And ever since then, it's just something that has really, really connected with me. It's a way to connect with our community. It's a way to give back, and we have a lot of fun during the process. So for me, it's really about the charitable impact. Over $8.5 million last year to 300 charities in Northeast Florida. We're looking to make that number $9 million this year, and the way things are setting up, I'm sure it's going to be close to that.
Excellent. Now, tell us again quickly how all our listeners can vote in the volunteer challenge and help all those local charities out there.
Yeah, they can go online and to the PGA Tour website, select the Players' Championship, and the challenge is online. Please vote for the chairman, Kevin English. We are we've got our own competition going on right now with the leadership team of the Players. And the top vice chairman gets to give away additional money to charity as well. So it's all online. It's easy to vote, and it's something that we're really enjoying.
All right, tourchallenge.com to vote. Enjoy Players Week out there. Kevin English, Red Coat, 10th year of volunteering at the Players. Thanks so much, Kevin.
Thank you. Hope to see you at the Players.
And finally, this hour, it is Players Week, and golfers and attendees are seeing some changes at the stadium course.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Now, if you like golf or you just like socializing and networking, Sawgrass is the place to be. You'll spot Cole Pepper out there, certainly, at one point or another. Hey, Cole.
I feel like I see everybody I've ever met and then some when I go out to the Players'
exactly.
Championship. It really is the biggest social event / golf tournament / party of the year. And the best golfers in the world are descending on TPC Sawgrass. 48 of the world's top 50 will be in the field of the Players' Championship this year. There will be some changes that you'll notice in terms of the way that fans can watch the tournament. But as far as the biggest change for the competitors, it's the par 4 12th. Maybe best known as the place closest to the tacos in the past, Tacos on 12. Now, though, it may become the greatest risk-reward hole on the course. It's already full of such kinds of holes. They've gone from a 360-yard, fairly straightforward par 4 to now a drivable par 4. So a chance for some golfers to take out the driver and maybe go for a potential eagle. And that really means that 4, maybe 5 of the holes on the back 9 are now risk-reward holes. And that's going to create more drama, particularly on Sunday afternoon as it's coming down to the wire. In the past, you've really seen a lot of the drama happen on 14, 15, 16, 17, and then 18. Now I think that drama starts a little bit earlier with the change of 12.
All right. Now, Jason Day, the defending champion, but he's definitely not your pick for this year.
Well, and historically, nobody has ever repeated. In fact, only one player has ever, as the defending champion, finished in the top 5. That was Nick Price. So the hottest golfer on tour right now is Dustin Johnson, who's won 3 times this year. He's ranked number 1 in the world golf rankings. Rory McIlroy ranked 2nd, followed by Day, Japan's Hideki Matsuyama, and Jordan Spieth also in the top 5. Johnson has never really played well here, though. And so when I start looking at who to pick, I'm looking for somebody who kind of fits here. I think at some point Rory will win here. He's played very well. McIlroy has finished in the top 12 each of the last 4 years. If you want a newcomer to keep an eye on, big-hitting 22-year-old Jon Rahm has finished in the top 10 in 6 of his last 8 tournaments, but he's never played here, so we'll see how it all plays out. But my pick for this year is Rory McIlroy.
You heard it here first.
To finally win at the Players. I won't be the only one picking Rory, but I'm going with Rory.
And when you say big hitter, all I can think of is big hitter the llama.
Big hitter the llama.
This is all that always pops right into my head. Okay, let's talk about the Armada. Undefeated over the weekend.
Yeah, and stayed that way in improbable fashion on Saturday night, trailing the 2-time defending champion New York Cosmos 1-0 in stoppage time. Zach Steinberger volleyed a leaping scissor kick of a shot from just inside the penalty area into the side netting to earn the Armada their 4th straight draw. I've called the Armada matches, as you know, Melissa, over the last 2-plus seasons. Mm-hmm. I can say that goal was one of the top three goals in the young history of the Armada might be the best goal scored in just in terms of pure artistry on the goal.
And the fan base seems to be growing for them, too.
Yeah, the great turnout and, of course, moving the games to UNF this year was a change. And so folks continue to sort of say, all right, are we ready for this? And they've turned out in droves. I think that there were some concerns over the offseason about what was going to happen with the club because of the changing of the league. But folks are now picking up on it. And this is a team that's very good. They'll go on the road for the next 2 weeks. They'll be back home May the 28th to face North Carolina FC.
And almost out of time, but the Sharks and the Jumbo Shrimp also had good weekends.
Sharks remain perfect on the season, now 7-0 after a 71-6 dismantling of the Corpus Christi Rage. This one was over before it began. The Sharks returned the opening kickoff for a touchdown and never looked back. Jumbo Shrimp split a doubleheader yesterday in Tennessee. They begin a five-game series against the Biloxi Shuckers tonight at the baseball ground.
The Shrimp against the Oysters. Yeah. All right. And follow Cole on Twitter, at Cole Pipper. Catch the Sam and Cole podcast, too. Thanks for being here.
Thanks,
and
Melissa.
Fighting traffic on the Main Street Bridge, too.
Yeah, was able to overcome.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us anytime. Next on 1A, what's next after the French elections? I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.